Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds. Well, Jay, here with Jay Welsh of JAMS, and first thing I have to say is we have to stop meeting up in Rome like this.
I know. This is the only place that we meet.
Yeah, here we are. By the way, we should get a plug for another mediation association in the offices of ADR Center, of all places, here in Rome. And I appreciate you taking the time to sit down and talk a little bit about you and JAMS.
Thanks for asking.
Let me ask, what is JAMS? What does it stand for?
Let me give you a kind of a two-minute history of JAMS. First of all, I'm Jay Welsh, and I'm the Executive Vice President and General Counsel of JAMS, and I've been with JAMS for 16 years. And JAMS was started 26 years ago by a judge in Orange County who decided that he could settle cases in a shopping center with his dog under the table just as easily as he could in the courthouse. And from that grew a company. It was then called Judicial Arbitration and Mediation Services. We have since shortened it to JAMS, JMS.
Which, by the way, everybody knows it just as
JAMS. And we spend a lot of money and time on the brand JAMS so that people do know it worldwide as JAMS. In 1989 or 90, Warburg Pincus bought the company. Investment bankers came in and felt that the whole ADR mediation concept could be like Federal Express, the privatization of a government function. But what they found was that it was harder to run over lawyers than it was mailmen. And so their concept of growing the company in volume with insurance cases, while at the same time having the reputation made by lead people at that time, like Jack Trotter, Coley Fan, and Dan Weinstein, who were doing complex cases, but all the marketing dollars were being spent at the bottom, was a concept that wasn't going to make anybody happy. So in 1998, 40 of us bought the company back. We made them an offer they couldn't refuse. And we bought the company back. We operate it now as it's for profit, but we operate it as a co-op. There are now 81 owners. We all own one share each. It has no equity value. When you die or leave, it goes away. And we operate it for the benefit of the people who are doing the work as mediators and arbitrators, and not to maximize the bottom line. All of our mediators and arbitrators are full-time. We decided that there were a couple of tenants that were going to be the cornerstone of JAMS and that we think makes us successful. One of them is everybody who is with us works exclusively with us. In other words, we manage all of their practice, all of their work from wherever they get it, and we do hundreds and hundreds of cases under AAA rules. We do ICC cases. But all of those cases are managed by JAMS and managed by the neutral's case manager. So all of their work is through JAMS. And all of the people with us, with one or two minor exceptions, are full-time mediators or arbitrators. We do not take lawyers who are practicing 3 days a week and trying to mediate one day a week. We have found it just doesn't work. So everybody with us is doing this 5 days, 6 days a week.
And you've been with the organization since its inception?
No, it was formed in 79. I joined in 91. But I joined at a point in time when we were still pretty small.
Where were you before that?
I practiced law in San Francisco. I was a business real estate lawyer. I was not a litigator. I joined as general counsel, but my role as general counsel at that time was to preach the mediation gospel to other general counsel. So it was more of a marketing role than it is now. I was the one who got Wells Fargo to adopt JAMS as the in their arbitration clause, which was the first time a national company had selected JAMS. So from that, we began to get known on a national basis.
Go ahead.
And you're still the general counsel.
Yes, I've never gotten a promotion. But the role has changed. Now I'm the buck stops with me on 11,000 cases a year, arbitrations we do. We're a 70-30 split between mediation and arbitration. We're 70% mediation by revenue and about 30% arbitration.
Right. Do you act as a mediator?
No,
as well? You don't.
I mediated in the mid-90s, and I decided that really the role that I was doing as part of senior management, there are three of us at the top of JAMS, the CEO, myself, and the CFO. And it's big enough. And to compete with our people, one of the reasons why we have exclusive people is when you book somebody at JAMS for, you know, the month of November for an arbitration, nothing is going to get in the way of that because that time is booked out. If the person is a lawyer or if he was the general counsel, it's likely that there would be something to get in the way. So, no, I don't mediate anymore. I sit in on mediations. I co-mediate, keep my hand in, and I do a lot of training in mediation of our new people coming in.
Are you involved in the mediator selection process or helping parties find the right mediator?
Yes, all the time. I get calls all the time. A lot of it is sub rosa. People call me and say, look, we have a big class action. We have this kind of case. We have an arbitration. I need somebody who is not scared to make a call, a tough decision. And I'm very forthright in giving them my feeling on who would be the right selection. But we do that in our local offices all over the country for lawyers who call and ask. Right. It's interesting that this business, and we have grown from zero to, you know, even though we're a private company, over $100 million U.S. dollars in revenue a year. This is a comeback, repeat business. If people don't come back to you, if you're a mediator, the cost of getting that first case is very high. We spend a lot to get you the cases. If the people aren't coming back to you, the lawyers, selecting you on other cases, then you're doing something wrong in the room. And we try to find out what's going on because really about two-thirds of our calls are mediator-specific. They're calling for Michael, they're calling
for
Jay.
I want that person.
Yeah, I want her. But they also, more and more, are saying, I want her on that date. So because they have prearranged the second week in November, they can do it. Well, if the person they want is not available.
That happens so often, by the way. You know, it's like you get, this is a big case. You got lots of people involved, and you look at your calendar. Right. We can do a mediation when? And second week of November, Wednesday or Thursday.
Right. And so that's good for us because if that person is not available, that permits us to suggest other people and move it to somebody else. Because let me tell you, the good people at JAMS are, you know, Dan Weinstein's booked out till first quarter of next year.
Wow. But you don't have a particular mediation style at JAMS, right? Do you have a style when you say somebody comes to JAMS? Is it, you know, we have high quality mediators, or that we have a particular type of mediator, or we do a particular type of mediation?
I started videoing some of our, what I call our senior mediators, because we have been really growing since the early 90s, mid 90s, but 50% of our revenue comes from people who weren't with us in 2000. So it's a constant recruiting process. But we're getting some of our senior people, the people who made JAMS brand, are getting older, and I wanted to interview them on video. And that started a project which was very interesting, because in videoing a number of our people of various ages, all of whom have extremely successful practices, I found that most of them do it differently. Everybody has a different style. And the marketplace really decides what style is going to be acceptable to them. Let me give you an example. Jack Trotter and Coley Fannin, who recently retired, both did joint sessions in basically every case they ever did. And each of them has done 5,000, 6,000.
What when you say joint session? For somebody who hasn't been in a mediation.
Okay, if you haven't been in a mediation, it is traditional to be taught, and it's traditional that the mediation opens with a joint session. Everybody around the table, the mediator then lays the ground rules, talks to the parties about what's going to happen, and the lawyers, normally, if it's a business case, the lawyers will be asked to make an opening statement, talk about their case, and then from there, every mediator has a different style. Let me just give you an example. Coley Fannin did 5,000-6,000 mediations and asked the same question at every joint session. He went around the table and asked, his opening question was, how do you think we can best use our time today? And he let everybody around talk. And I asked him, I said, what happens if one of the lawyers launches into their opening statement? Do you interrupt him? He said, yes. I interrupt him and say, oh, I get it. You think that we should use our time listening to your opening statement. Okay. Then he goes to the next person. Well, you know, he could get away with that because of his style. But everybody I found has a different style. There are people who are equally as successful who never do joint sessions.
Nope.
They start immediately in private caucus, and the reason is because they say that there is more damage done in the joint session, and it takes them hours to undo the damage. And they would rather start in a private caucus and maybe sometime during the day bring the parties together. But sometimes they don't.
Do you see a trend towards that now? Or?
I see more of a trend, particularly there's a lawyer here. Michael and I are sitting in Rome at a conference. There's an American lawyer here who is a very experienced defense lawyer. She has been a lawyer in over 500 mediations. Well, you know, I mean, bringing her into a joint session to talk about what's going to happen today, unless she has a client. Now, her client's going to be really an insurance carrier, and the kinds of cases she does, it's going to be a senior insurance claims person who hasn't had 500 mediations also. So when you're with experienced people around the table, unless there is somebody from a bank, from an institution, a business person from GE who needs to hear some things about what's going to happen, then you would have a joint session. But it would mainly be for that person's benefit.
So but in terms of an overall mediation practice, I mean, do you think that this is a new development? The idea is, frankly, I've never been to a mediation in which there was no joint session.
Yeah. I think most...
Which, by the way, maybe because my own experience tends to be outside the U.S. here in Europe and places, well, apart from the U.K., where it's very well developed as a practice, but a lot of the places where we do mediation, it's still relatively new. And so the joint session is, you know, in fact... I'll be honest with you, when you describe how mediation takes place, and I give my pitch to the internal people, I tell them what's going to happen. I say, well, first there's going to be a joint session, and then we're going to break off.
What you would say then, if the mediator said, and the mediator normally says, I really prefer not to have a joint session, you would say, well, I want you to have a joint session because I've told my people that they're going to have a joint session. And I think it's important for users of mediators to understand that this is their process. And you should feel perfectly free to tell the mediator, no, this is the way it will be.
Well, no, I'm not, actually, to be honest with you, I'm not taking a position for or against joint sessions here. I just had never heard of a mediation being effective. And not having had a joint session where the parties can sit in a room, look at each other, and say what they feel and what they believe. That's just, that's how I've learned to do things. You're telling me there's a different way of doing it that may even be more effective in certain cases. And frankly, I hadn't thought of that, sort of.
Well, you're describing a process where somebody on the other side of the table may care about what you feel. and there may be some kind of relationship that is in jeopardy and needs to be preserved. We have found as media, and remember that the kind of mediation we do is in complex, big cases. And we find that most of the time the parties are not going to be involved with each other after the mediation.
What percentage would you say are these? So what you're describing basically is the interest-based versus the non-interest-based, or the where there's a relationship or the hope of a relationship, or where there's, I guess, the typical example, an insurance company and a personal injury case, right? I mean, there's the two of them are not looking to an ongoing relationship.
Nor is the class action plaintiff lawyer and the drug manufacturer who manufactured the bad drug. Nor is the class action lawyer in a wage and hour case for the most part. Nor is the law firm that's breaking up or these people, it's not about putting them back together again. It's nice to be taught interest-based mediation. I sometimes feel I get jaded, but that's because I preside over so many of these cases, and I see people coming and talking about win-win when I have a feeling that more of it is lose-lose. The job of the mediator is to convince the plaintiff to take less than he ever thought he would want to take, and convince the defendant to pay more than they ever thought they were going to pay at the beginning. And that's what makes this a very tough business.
Mediating a zero-sum game, basically.
You've got to get them to a place that they swore. They raised their right hand before they went in the room and they said, we're not going there, right? And everybody said, yes, right. And then at the end of the day, you've got to get them there.
Then let me ask you. Tough cases, really difficult cases, complex cases. What makes a great mediator that can help you settle cases like that?
That's a very interesting question. I think it's a combination of things. And I think it is mostly reputation. I've thought about this and I think 80%, up to 80% of the success of a very successful mediator is reputation, personal charisma, personal power, personality, and then 20% is technique.
But when you say reputation, you mean the reputation of the mediator before she or he comes into the room?
Yes.
And so the parties already have to respect that person.
Absolutely. When you have an important case and you select somebody like Jack Trotter or Dan Weinstein, who are two names of people who are well known at JAMS in the United States, who do big cases, when you select them, you know by their reputation that they have done the Enron case. They have, you know what they've done. Quest. They've done all of these major, major cases. Aaron Bronkovich, they did. So you know that their reputation precedes them. And the more cases that somebody does at a high level, the more apt the parties are or their counsel are to listen to them. And so it's like a log rolling thing. It is that the more important cases you have, the more important cases you settle, the more the parties are going to listen to you and your advice at some point during the day. And that respect feeds on it, and so it's
self-reinforcing.
It's self-reinforcing.
Yeah. And I guess from a party perspective, if you want a mediator who's really going to help you settle, you're going to want somebody that you and the other party respect a great deal.
Exactly.
So it actually feeds, yeah.
And there are different styles. We have people who become your rabbi, become your friend. We have others who are not your friend and are keep at arm's length. And at some point in the day, there is a similarity on all of the styles, is that at some point in the day, most of the time, and you'll notice I'm weaseling, because the lawyers are going to want to know whether what is on the table is reflective of what the mediator thinks is appropriate. Now, that's a long-handed way of saying that eventually they want the mediator to become somewhat evaluative. They don't want to be hung out to dry, and they want somebody who they respect to say, you know, this is something you've got to really consider because this is a lot of money.
Right.
So more and more, which is why in the United States we have found that former judges, the right people, and we turn down a lot more than we accept at JAMS, the right person who has a former judicial background is more likely to be listened to than somebody who is a senior lawyer. It's very tough for one lawyer to take the advice of another lawyer.
I guess that's right, yeah. It's a judge. It's funny, I'd always heard that judges, and forgive me here, the judges can make terrible mediators. In fact, I've mentioned this to people. My mother is a retired judge in California who often insisted that she used to do mediation. I mean, she still sits as a judge sometimes, and she tries to mediate all of her cases. She just gets the parties to settle. And I've always felt that the ongoing argument I've had with her is that, you know, that's not mediation. That's just, you know, strong-arming the parties into settlement, which is, I think, is almost one of the duties of a judge to try to get the parties to do. So that I'd always heard this and had personal experience that might confirm with respect to my mom that, mm-hmm. that maybe being a judge wasn't one of the best skills of being a mediator.
Yeah. Well, that's said a lot. But time and time again, we will take a former judge, and immediately that person will skyrocket in revenue because of the reputation and then the skill. They've got to get the skill. We have people who don't meet expectations, and the marketplace soon finds that out, and they won't select them. The best indicator of whether somebody is successful is whether they're being selected a second time.
Second time, right.
Yeah.
What about the other, the personal skills? He says, so reputation is a big component.
Yes.
First thing I said, reputation and personal interpersonal skills or personality are about 80%.
I mean,
20% technical. What's in the personality?
My goodness, what's in the personality? The ability to connect with people?
Right. He's like, if you're a party, I'm a party.
Yeah.
So if I'm looking for a mediator,
right.
How do I scout that out? How do I get information about that?
Well, you know, more and more what you're going to do is you're going to talk to other counsel who've used them. Every law firm has the email system, which goes, through his look. Judge X has been proposed as a mediator in this case. Anybody know anything? You'll get 15 emails in the U.S. from people who say, yes, the person's good. No, the person's terrible.
Oh, sure.
And you know, if you haven't used them before, that's how you're going to find out. Normally, their reputation on the bench precedes them. We have had some very successful mediators who were rude and abrasive people, and that we inherited them. They were very successful. And I would get calls from lawyers telling me that this person was rude to them. And I said, well, do you live in a box someplace? Yes, he's rude. Did your case settle? Well, yes, it settled. You know, he made me settle. I said, how could he make you settle? You can get up and walk away. You know, this
so it's like going to eat at a restaurant in New York. You know, you pay to be mistreated.
But that was years ago. Now that's not tolerated by the marketplace because you have people who are so experienced. The mediation business is very different now than it was in 95. In 1995, the mediators knew more about mediation than the lawyers did. That's not true today. The lawyers who use mediation on a day-to-day basis in the United States know a lot about what the mediator is going to do, what the mediator knows, what their moves are. It's like the old joke of telling a joke in prison. You know, they've told it so much, they give it numbers. Guy gets up and says number 23. Everybody laughs except one guy, and they say, why aren't you laughing? He says, well, I think Joe tells it better than him. So the mediator has to stay fresh. He can't use tired, any mediator that gets up in the United States today and starts talking about the cost of defense and, you know, what's it going to be and everything, those are old tired things. You've got to get past that kind of mediation technique fairly quickly.
Well, let me put things in a perspective of a non-U.S. company.
Yes.
Looking, that's maybe doing selling in the United States, contracting with the U.S., and whether to include mediation in the contract.
Yes.
Isn't that part of the pitch right up front, though, to say the costs and, you know, the idiosyncrasies of the U.S. system are such that, you know, you almost, as a foreign company, cannot afford not to put a mediation clause into any significant contracts in the U.S. I mean, you've got things that you have in the U.S. that you don't have other places, or, you know, juries in civil cases, the lack of fee shifting to the losing party, contingency fees, you know, an extremely expensive disclosure or discovery practice that you really don't encounter, or you encounter it much less outside the U.S. And certainly, you know, for civil law countries or parties located in civil law countries, these impose incredible costs. Can you justify, I guess, not putting
The issue of the cost of litigation in the United States for a foreign company that's not used to that kind of system is just enormous, and foreign companies are not used to it. So, yes, I believe that mediation is going to save them a lot of money. But the big thing is that they're going to be able to achieve a result that they're in control of. And the second basic item is that they're going to be able to achieve something that they can't get in arbitration or in a court. Those two things, the control and the ability to fashion a settlement that is going to go beyond what they could get in arbitration or in court, would be enough for me to say, let's give it a try.
Right, but I guess my point is just one that, you know, having access to dispute, you know, alternative like this could make buying and selling into the U.S. or with U.S. parties a lot more efficient, really,
yes,
a lot more effective. What about JAMS and you guys internationally, outside of, you know, this vast U.S. experience that you have? What are you doing on the international? We're in Rome, so you must be doing something. Although it's not a bad place to come.
And it's one where if you like car horns, it's the place. It is absolutely the place to come. We decided that the role for us in Europe was to form an alliance, which we did, called MedAl, with the ADR Center in Rome, CMAP in France, a group in Holland, and then Cedar in London. We started with an alliance with Cedar, and then expanded it to include the major groups in each country. We already do a lot of international arbitration. We have international rules. More and more U.S. companies are adopting JAMS international arbitration rules because they are more friendly to the lawyers. They are not front-end loaded with costs. You know, arbitration at JAMS, you don't write a big check to get in the door. So it's a pay-as-you-go system.
No advance on fees.
No advance. It's $500 or something like that to file an arbitration at JAMS. So that's because we feel that parties should have the ability to settle and not have an investment in fees,
right.
Nor do we have fees that are dependent upon the amount in controversy,
right.
You know.
I've had, you know, a lot of people say the advance on fees is advantageous because you know what the costs are going to be at the outset. And that is actually a useful tool to be able to say this is what, at least leaving aside the legal fees, you know what the cost of the arbitrators and the institution will be, and it's this amount because it's based on the amount in dispute. But in practice, what we found is it does, in fact, create something of an investment in the dispute because you've paid it. Although people don't realize it, but this is, I should say this at least to the benefit or to the credit of some of the institutions that do have these advances. My experience has been that if you settle early, but you have to settle very early after having paid the advance, you can get back, not all of it, but a big portion of it.
To settle very early.
But you have to settle. The earlier you settle, the better chance you have of getting some or all back. So we
do, our people sit on ICC panels, on AAA panels. I mean, we do AAA arbitrations every day. So, we manage the practices of what we think are the best neutrals in the country. But we also realized that the state of ADR in Europe was that we were probably not going to be selected unless there was an American-based company involved some way. And for us to open an office here in Europe with the level of ADR being what it is was not what we think we should be doing. I want to open in South Florida before I open in France. I mean, I'd like to spend more time in Paris, but I think I've got there are other parts of the country that we have to penetrate.
We do a lot of business in Rio.
That's it. And come up through Miami.
Quickly, mm-hmm. Class mediations.
We are doing more and more class mediations. And I can't remember when there has been a class action case tried. I mean, we did the Enron. We did all of the Enron class action securities. We do huge numbers of securities cases, mass tort drug cases. We're doing Zyprexa. We did Fenfen. We did Rezolin. So wherever there is a bad drug, multiple injury case, we end up not only settling but also handling the allocation. What has happened in the U.S. is when you have plaintiff lawyers representing large numbers of injured parties, when they try to allocate the fund themselves, they ended up getting sued because there was obviously a conflict of interest because there wasn't separate representation for each 8,000 members of the injured group because all their injuries were different. So we do a lot of allocation between and set up matrices and set up processes for the allocation of the funds among the plaintiff group. And we've done it in drug cases. We've done it in environmental cases.
And that's something for right now. It's limited probably just to the U.S., I think, not just because of you folks, but also because I think the class action tool, it just for this type of injury isn't usually available outside the U.S.
That's as I understand. Yeah.
GE.
GE.
Any experiences with us in mediation that you can tell us about? This is,
Yes, I know that we have handled a number of GE cases. GE is very sophisticated in the use of ADR and the selection of neutrals, and I think has always prided itself on being sophisticated and advanced in using ADR. So we know that when you go in the room with GE, they're going to know what to do, how to act, how to effectively be an advocate in a mediation, which, as you know, is different than being in court. And mediation advocacy, I know you teach it, and I know others teach it. It's different. You are the story of going into a mediation and asking the attorney to kind of give his opening, and when he starts by saying that the other side had been paddling down the river of deceit, that's when the mediator raises his hand and says, wait a minute, that's not really what we meant by mediation advocacy. But I can't, just sitting here in Rome, remember any specific cases, but I know that we have done any number of them. And always, I think, with sophistication and success, hopefully.
Well, I hope the success for us.
Well, put it this way. If you agreed to it, was successful.
But you made us settle.
Oh, man. If you knew how many times I've heard that. They made us settle. I didn't like him because he made me settle.
Well, listen, Jay, thanks so much for taking the time.
At least I know one thing. At least I know that GE is never going to say, I'm not going to bid against myself.
Well, I hope we get that one out of the room. Or actually, let us know if you hear that one coming from the room.
I will. Thank you, Mike.
All right.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.